students with, particularly in schools, I think, where you have a great need. And that kind of goes back to that CBO conversation we had a little bit earlier about how can community-based organizations help, particularly in areas of more distress.
John Sweeney, so they need somebody to talk with. And this is important so that they, you know, sometimes they feel better talking to a stranger. And one thing about having a health professional to talk with is the fact that you have somebody that has real facts rather than innuendos and false information.
Join Kay Boo tomorrow evening at 5:45 as we continue our coverage of Portland school board elections. If you have more questions about the candidates or the upcoming Portland Public School Board elections, let us know on Facebook. Look for Kay Boo Radio and leave a comment. Or you can email pmnews@kboo.org or call us at 503-231-8032. Your questions may be featured as part of an upcoming Kay Boo School Board special program. Ballots for the school board elections are due by May 19th.
Portland school board elections are May 19th. What are the candidates saying?
My name is Jose Gonzalez. I'm executive director and founder of Milagro. I'm Mexican-American and a graduate of Benson High School. I'm running for school board in Zone 2 because I think we have a great opportunity to make a difference, and I want to be part of it.
Tune into KBOO April 27th through the 30th at 5:45 for special school board election coverage.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Radio Cab, serving the metro area since 1946 with service 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. Radio Cab offers airport service, wheelchair-accessible vans, and can be reached at 503-227-1212. In Vancouver at 360-694-1234 or RadioCab.net.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Music Fest Northwest, presenting a weekend of music on the waterfront with Danny Brown, Modest Mouse, Beirut, Bell and Sebastian, Tallest Man on Earth, Foster the People, Twin Shadow, and more. Tickets and full lineup at musicfestnw.com.
Welcome to Out Loud, dear listeners. Thanks for tuning in tonight. You can find us online at kboo.fm. We archive our shows. We're also on Facebook, KBOO Out Loud. You can keep track of what we're doing on the show, as well as some of the news and events happening around town. We try to compile a decent list of local news and national news, what comes across our desk. We have with us on the telephone Sasha Buchert. Sasha,
hey.
Are you? Hey there.
Hi, Alan.
Welcome.
Thank you. Welcome. Thanks for having me on the program.
Absolutely. People have been commenting lately on our doll videos on Facebook. Maybe someday we'll do a radio show about those and how exciting it was to do a little play acting.
Wait, what is it?
The YouTube, the videos we loaded on YouTube. We had dolls enacting stories.
Those are a little troubling. Well, we should devote a whole show to that, a whole program.
Sasha, welcome back to Out Loud. You're a regular and valued guest, and you were once a longtime host of Out Loud.
Yeah, I did some radio, some volunteer work at KBOO. Loved it, loved my KBOO community. I did a little bit of news and hosted Out Loud with you and Carla and some of the other folks there, and miss it. So, hello, Portland.
Yay. How are you? I mean, what's going on? How are you?
I'm really great. Yeah. I miss everybody, but, you know, it's nice being down in the Bay Area. It's just a hop, skip, and a jump from Portland, and get to, you know, come up there soon.
Good.
I heard you all have had nice weather. Not to talk about the weather. but
yeah. Well, we're all going to be climate refugees soon enough, right?
Exactly.
People are pouring into the city and just getting started with that. The local governments, the news came out last week, the local governments are actually preparing for a fairly massive wave of climate refugees in the coming decades. They're beginning to sort of set up the city to be able to handle that. So I guess it's nice that we're thinking ahead, thinking forward on that. The best we can do is take care of each other locally. It's sort of hard to fix the whole globe from just sitting where we are. But there's a lot going on, and we can take a look around the country and see what's happening, see what's up. There's good news, there's bad news. You work now in Oakland for the Transgender Law Center.
Yeah, there's a lot going on. You know, it's the best of times and worst of times. You know, you look at what's happening in Baltimore and around the country, you know, with the military state, and it's very, very troubling, you know, the way that communities of color have been impacted, you know, by the law enforcement, and it's just really sad. So my hearts are with the people of Baltimore and all inner cities and folks who are dealing with this struggle.
Mm-hmm. Agreed. Thank you for bringing that up. Tell us a little bit about the Transgender Law Center, based in Oakland, California.
Yeah. So we've been around since around 2002, I think. I've been here since 2013, and we are a nonprofit national organization that works to change law and policy so that we can create a world where everybody can live safely and authentically, regardless of their gender identity or gender expression. And we've, you know, done a lot of work specifically in California, you know, making, you know, women's health care for folks and, you know, trans and gender non-conforming folks, and passing, you know, progressive identity document regulations and laws, and been doing a lot of work around the country, especially with litigation, you know, recently, especially. So we've done a lot of, historically, a lot of prison work, and we've just started to ramp that work up again in the last year or so. So I'm really proud of that. And also some work around immigration detention and the struggle that, you know, specifically our transgender Latinas, you know, immigrant Latinas who, you know, often inappropriately housed and discriminated against and within ICE, you know, so lots of work going on for sure. But we've, you know, been around what you're doing since 2002 and work on a variety of areas, but that's our area of specialties is, you know, policy and litigation and public education.
It must be incredibly difficult to intervene in the prison system.
It is, yeah. You know, it's a perfect storm of, you know, just really Byzantine bureaucratic government, you know, processes combined with, you know, some a lot of regressive, punitive attitudes about, you know, how folks should be treated, you know, once they're incarcerated, you know, and completely oblivious to, you know, the systemic factors, you know, that go into, you know, pipelining folks, you know, into those institutions. You know, you have to stand back and wonder, you know, you can't just, you know, cite the statistic that, you know, people of color disproportionately, you know, housed, and I'm not even talking about, I can talk about transgender people that are incarcerated in those systemic forces that, you know, do that, you know, ad nauseum, but I think it's just it's bigger than that, though. It's obviously, and this is an obvious point for, I'm sure, all listeners, listeners, but, you know, it's just really important to keep pointing out, though, that, you know, it's not, you know, there's a reason, you know, that folks are being incarcerated. Situations like that is beginning to be, you know, unearthed in, like, Ferguson and other places where people are, you know, criminalized because of unpaid fines and you know, really, you know, over-policing in neighborhoods and stopping and frisking, you know, laws that, you know, freely disproportionately impact those folks. You know, it's just, it's a widespread issue. So, but it does, you know, impact specifically, you know, trans folks and specifically trans folks of color, you know, and it starts in the school systems, you know, when students, you know, are bullied for being trans or are overly disciplined, you know, of course, you know, they end up leaving school, which leaves them, you know, permanently disadvantaged economically, because we know what happens when you can't get a proper education, you know, in our culture, and you know, places them at the fringe into street economies like sex work or drug work, and that often leads to, you know, being enmeshed in the prison industrial complex. So, you know, it's a huge, huge issue for trans folks, and then, you know, once incarcerated, you know, it's a specifically dangerous place to be, and you know, specifically for trans folks who, you know, transgender women, for example, that are incarcerated at 13 times more likely to be sexually assaulted than other inmates, and you know, it's just a very, very brutal and place to be as a transgender person. So, you know, we work on a lot of the issues that around making it safer for folks, so that they're able to, you know, to reduce the amount of assault in prison. And specifically, we work on healthcare issues too. And really proud of a recent victory that we had. We for just the second time in our nation's history, you know, a district court judge you know, in a case that we were co-counseling on, ordered gender reassignment surgery for a prisoner who had been in prison for 30 years, and we're very excited about that. Unfortunately, the state has appealed it, so we're going to have to go through, you know, that litigation process. But it was a huge victory and a huge step forward, and the judge recognizing that denying this treatment, you know, is denying her constitutionally adequate treatment and is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. So I am talking a lot. Sorry.
That's okay. That's okay.
Wake up, people. Hopefully, everybody's driving and listening.
I want to mention we have Boston in the control booth.
Oh, great! Hey, Boston.
What's up? How's it going?
But yeah, so we've just been really busy. Another huge victory that we had that I'm very proud of is that we're representing a transgender woman who is a civilian who works for the Department of Army and was denied access to a restroom consistent with her gender identity. What happens a lot of times when trans folks are employed is that the employer, you know, once, you know, he or she begins to transition, you know, the employer will be, well, you know, you know, we're not going to force you to use the wrong restroom, but we're not going to allow you to use the restroom consistent with your gender identity either, because, you know, God knows what will happen. Somebody will be uncomfortable. So we're going to make you use this, you know, single stall restroom down the hall and three floors down in a basement somewhere, and we'll give you a special key, and, you know, and we're really mean to her too. They, you know, we harassed her and used the wrong pronouns with her frequently, and she came to us and we helped her, you know, appeal a case, and we won. So it was a huge precedent-setting victory, you know, that, you know, employment discrimination means more than just not hiring somebody because they're transgender. You know, it means any adverse action, and that includes denying, you know, them the ability to use a restroom consistent with their gender identity, or harassing them by using the wrong name or pronoun. So really excited about that. So we've got our hands full, you know, with a couple of huge cases and a lot of other work that we're doing, but yeah.
Now, as I understand it, that particular case was decided on the basis of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act?
Yeah. Yeah, this is nerdy, weedy stuff, folks, so grab your cup of coffee. Yeah, unfortunately, so to take a long story short, you know, unfortunately, gender identity and sexual orientation, and hopefully some, you know, people know the difference, but I'll just say it real quickly. So sexual orientation is who you're attracted to, and gender identity is how you identify. It's your intrinsic identity, your intrinsic understanding of who you are on the inside, you know, either male or female or somewhere in between. But yeah, so unfortunately, we don't have federal protections for, you know, folks who identify as LGBT, make it even break it down. So we need those, and until we have those, we've built on case law, which has interpreted the prohibition on sex discrimination across the country to include gender identity and sex stereotyping, you know, which has been applied to both transgender people and gay and lesbian folks. So we've had a lot of great success with that, and this is one of those cases where the court, well, it built on a prior case, you know, that we had brought, expanding that understanding with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission that sex should include gender identity, but then that case was in the context of hiring. So the EEOC said, oh, you know, that definitely gender identity is part of sex discrimination, you know, but unfortunately, in this most recent case, you know, the defendants were arguing that, well, yeah, you know, it's true that gender identity is protected under sex discrimination, but that's just for hiring. That doesn't apply to the bathroom, you know, and we said it does, and it does. So that was really great. But yeah, it's building on a body of case law that's interpreted sex discrimination to include gender identity protections and sex stereotyping. So.
Well, congratulations, and thank you for your good work in that case. So I want to go back to thinking about the law and how it works, and I don't mean that in a positive way, how it operates.
Wait, you want to talk about what? The law?
Yeah, I want to talk about the law, how it operates.
Okay.
So I want to start really generally, and I want to ask you to talk about some of the ways that transgender folks have historically been criminalized.
Yeah, that's a really great question. And I think that I've touched on this a little bit, but I'll just start with in a number of ways. Historically, it starts again with school-to-prison pipeline, you know, and it's not just for, you know, trans folks. This is largely true for folks of color, you know, when you're not able to, you know, be in school, you know, for whatever reason, if you're, you know, LGBT youth are often overly disciplined. And then, unfortunately, the other issue is acceptance. When, you know, we know that a lot of youth, LGBT youth, specifically trans youth and gender non-conforming youth, face a lot of hostility in the home, unfortunately, still. And there was a study done by Listen, it's a student organization that works with youth. And one of the statistics that came out of a study that they did recently was that 40% of the homeless youth identify as LGBT. And unfortunately, we don't have, you know, the hard data we need for trans folks because we've just been excluded so often from a lot of these studies that have been done by the government. But we do know that it's a very, very large proportion. So once you're, you know, homeless again, you know, going back into, you know, the issue of being forced into street economies, folks end up turning to sex work or selling drugs or even sleeping, you know, in public spaces where they're more likely to be harassed or get entangled with law enforcement. You know, this makes them, you know, much more susceptible to, you know, getting involved with the criminal industrial complex or the prison industrial complex, excuse me. And then also employment discrimination, you know, when you can't find meaningful work, you know, if you're trans folks have double the rate of unemployment as non-transgender people because of employment discrimination. You know, it's rampant. Talk to any transgender person and they'll tell you, you know, that they have very, you know, huge challenges in finding work. And when you can't find meaningful work, again, you turn to those fringe economies, which again, you know, entangle you in those systems. Also, folks often talk about walking while being trans. You know, trans folks, you know, specifically trans women of color, you know, repeatedly tell me anecdotally that they're often stopped by police who just assume that they're involved in sex work. You know, and again, the more interactions you have with law enforcement, you know, the more likely it's gonna end up, you know, creating huge issues for you and entangling you in that system. And once you're in it, you know, then it becomes really challenging to get out of it because, you know, as we know, once folks are paroled or released, that it's very tough to, you know, successfully reenter, you know, and find meaningful employment, you know, with a punitive laws that are on the books, you know, that a lot of trans folks face, and specifically trans folks of color. So it's those are just some of the challenges, you know, the school to prison pipeline, employment discrimination, and walking while trans are the things that come to mind.
I have a lot more questions, but I'd like to take a break and listen to a little music. Will you hang out with us?
Of course.
All right, wonderful. We'll be back shortly. Thanks, Sasha.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Out Loud, folks. That was the ever inspirational Stephanie Mills. I hope I get to see her in concert.
So powerful.
I know. I hope I get to see her in concert someday. Coming up at the end of May is something I'm very excited about. Midnight Star. Do you remember Midnight Star?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I do.
Yeah. Yeah, Jamila.
I still love them.
Jamila, who hosts Guess Who's Coming to Radio here on KBOO on Thursdays, I think every other Thursday, and I are very excited about this. Early 80s funk band. Check them out, people. They're just crazy fun. And, you know, we don't often get to see bands that, you know, have been touring for decades, and it's just a dream gig, and here we are. Okay, so I want to thank you for staying online, Sasha. I want to dig into a couple of things, slow down, and look at a couple of things that you mentioned in passing. One of them is Fierce, which is an organization in New York City. Is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tell us what Fierce is.
I don't really know that much about them, so I don't think I'm a great person to talk deeply about them. I know that they're, you know, a youth group that have done amazing work and have done a lot of movement building there, and specifically around, you know, issues impacting youth of color, but I don't think I'm the person to go deeply into who they are and the work that they do, you know, because I'm kind of locked into the West Coast here, you know, more so than, you know, we don't do a lot of work with them, so.
Okay, that's okay. It's a subject for a future program here in KBOO. We'll find the Fierce folks and you know, see what they're up to in New York City. I want to ask you about the Bay Area then. Do you have a sense of what it's like for trans folks in general in the Bay Area? I don't have any sort of specific. It's a very squishy question.
Yeah, well, maybe we can just talk a little bit national, you know, about the national landscape too. Just, you know, I think that one thing that, you know, is really troubling, you know, especially, you know, I was really proud to hear Mary Bonato from, you know, Gay and Lesbian Advocates and Defenders, you know, defend, you know, argue in front of the Supreme Court today. She did an amazing, amazing job, you know, to, you know, win the freedom to marry, you know, for those last few states that don't have it, you know, but, you know, I think that hopefully that really will go the right way. But I think that, you know, in stepping back and looking past the freedom, you know, the freedom to marry, you know, for, you know, loving and committed gay and lesbian folks, there's a lot of really awful legislation that's been introduced, you know, in this session, you know, across the country targeting, LGBT folks, you know, beyond Indiana, you know, with the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, you know, that you would enshrine discrimination, you know, and try to create a solution for problems that just don't exist, and would just be really, really deeply traumatic for folks, you know, and living in those places, you know, with that kind of legislation would be really, really, really be awful, specifically for trans folks. We've witnessed legislation that would criminalize and create civil penalties for going to the bathroom. It sounds ridiculous, absolutely, but in Kentucky,
let us come back to that topic.
Okay.
I've got it as a stop along the way.
Can talk about healthcare. That's better. We've had some great advancement in healthcare for trans folks across the country recently. You know, California kind of started the ball rolling, and Oregon was close behind, and eliminating healthcare exclusions for trans folks. And now there are, I think, I believe 10 or 11 states now that have you know, followed California and Oregon's lead in prohibiting private insurers, you know, that are supervised by the state insurer from, you know, listing categorical exclusions, you know, blanket exclusions in their plan, denying care to people just because they're transgender, you know. So it's really, really positive. New York State, I think, is the most recent, you know, to do that. Also, even better is that along with that, we're seeing more and more states' Medicaid, you know, plans and their exclusions as well. Medicare did as well last year, but more and more states are requiring their Medicaid plans to and their discriminatory exclusions, which is really important, obviously, because Medicaid is a safety net. So, you know, because of the issues we touched on earlier regarding systemic discrimination, employment discrimination, et cetera, that, you know, a lot of folks end up needing to use that safety net. So there's a disproportionate number of trans and gender nonconforming folks who are in the Medicaid systems across the country. So the expansion of it generally with Obamacare was, you know, a positive development, and now removing those prohibited or discriminatory exclusions has been really helpful as well. One thing that we're working on in California, just to answer your question specifically, that I'm really excited about, is that we have introduced a bill that would prohibit state contractors from having exclusions in their plans or denying unequal benefits for state contractors that do business with the state of California. So really proud of that. We've gone through two committees now, and we're expecting that to move forward, you know, quickly. So we'd be the first state in the country to do that as well, and hopefully other states will follow our lead, specifically Oregon.
Wonderful. I'm excited about all of that. And I know there's some push to privatize Medicare. That sounds terribly scary. It sounds like it's an attempt to undermine.
This is out of my league, too. So let other KBOO experts talk about that. But yeah. I think that that's been a discussion that's been raised, you know, that, you know, in privatizing our entitlement programs through the years. And the solutions have always been, from my understanding, fairly hazy. Something about a tool or a lockbox or something, you know, with some really sketchy numbers that have been proposed. And I'm sorry, but if the way that privatization has worked in other places, you know, for other contexts, that just sounds like a complete disaster. Mm-hmm. It's just scary to think that, you know, that we would entrust, you know, our entitlement programs, you know, our safety nets for the most vulnerable among us to companies that have, in my opinion, very zero integrity for the most part, you know, in private industry. I just, you know, it's just greed and capitalism. I'm sorry, I'm showing my socialist feathers, but, you know, it's just, it's not a good plan, in my opinion. Again, I'm not speaking intelligently to that, so I will defer. I'll stick to my lane, which is trans rights.
Sure. The Oregonian mentioned the other day, I have no idea what the data is, so it might have been weeks ago, that unions exist only for the benefit of their workers. This was an editorial, which of course isn't true because unions tackle a lot of things, but do they mention that corporations exist solely for the benefit of their owners? No, they probably don't mention that. You mentioned ICE. Do you want to explain what ICE is?
Yeah, so ICE is the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. It's the government agency that oversees our immigration policies. And as we know, there are huge issues, you know, with the way that, you know, immigrants are over policed and subjectively decided, you know, how housing is subjectively decided often, and decisions are subjectively made. And there's, again, a lot of macro policy issues that I'll defer to other people with, but specifically for trans folks, the issue is that they've proven over and over again that they just cannot safely house transgender immigrant Latinos. You know, they, you know, are constantly being, you know, sexually assaulted and inappropriately housed. And we've, you know, done a lot of work with them, but they just, you know, have been very, very challenging. And we've had, you know, folks, you know, involved with direct action in Arizona and other places, you know, to move this forward. And it's brought a lot of visibility to, you know, the specific campaigns to end, you know, the inappropriate housing of transgender, you know, Latinas. But, you know, it's still a lot of work to be done. We're starting to see a little bit of movement, but not enough, you know, and we're definitely on the not one more side of this, you know, this discussion that there should, you know, should not be housing transgender women, because we just have proven over and over again that they're not capable of housing them safely.
Which, as you mentioned, is a concern for prisons in general.
Yeah, it is. And you know, unfortunately, we have the Prison Rape Elimination Act regulations, which, you know, were designed to make it, you know, things safer for this, for trans folks and for LGBT folks and, you know, people in general. But unfortunately, you know, because of the issues that I brought up earlier, that, you know, the structure, it's one thing to have the law, and everybody knows this, but it's a completely different thing to have a lived reality. And they should be making housing decisions, for example, not, you know, they have the highly scientific decision-making process of, if somebody has an innie, they're sent to women's prisons. If they have an outie, they're, if people know what I'm talking about, you know, it's very simplistic and fails to consider, you know, the whole range of identities, of sexual identity. And if a transgender woman, for example, who is somebody that's transitioned from male to female, could, you know, have been, you know, living her life as a woman for 20 years and have been on hormones for 20 years and become incarcerated and just, you know, callously placed in, you know, the wrong, in an immense facility, you know, which will obviously place her at great risk. And this actually happened recently in Georgia. There's a case involving a transgender woman named Ashley Diamond that the Southern Poverty Law Center brought a case forward in representing her, because she'd been in hormones and she was 17 years old and she was 30 something when she was arrested, and they just stopped her healthcare treatment. And she went through a really significant withdrawals, and they inappropriately housed her, and she was, you know, she was raped and she was sexually assaulted, and she was, you know, placed in very, very dangerous situations in a maximum security wing of the prison. And this is, you know, and it's really common for trans folks, because of the issues that I talked about earlier, to be, you know, it's really common for them to be housed and incarcerated for nonviolent crimes like theft or sex work or drug sales or whatever, and get housed with, you know, really, you know, folks who have a lot more propensity for violence. And you know, this is exactly what happened to her. She was placed in a maximum security ward and was assaulted. And, you know, thank God, you know, because Southern Poverty Law Center stepped in and took on the case. And I've heard, anyway, that she's beginning to get treatment now, so that's good. But there's a whole host of issues, whether it's searches or housing decisions or access to health care. You know, there's just a ton of issues that impact, you know, those vulnerable folks that are placed into that system.
Tell us about Michelle Lael Norsworthy.
Yeah, I talked about that a little bit already. But Michelle was Michelle's our client who is housed in a prison in California, and we have been working with her because she has been trying to access gender reassignment surgery as part of her healthcare needs, and she's been incarcerated for 30 some years and was denied care, you know, and the courts have said over and over and over again that, you know, and this is just true for any healthcare, you can't make these, and this is true for our private healthcare insurance too, you know, it's inappropriate to be making blanket categorical decisions about healthcare needs for people, especially, you know, you can't just say, oh, you know, all transgender people don't need this treatment, you know, that's not a constitutional basis to deny treatment or healthcare for people, you know, within the prison industrial complex, you know, because of animus or bias. So anyway, we helped her with her case, and that was the case that I was saying earlier with the, you know, we filed for a preliminary injunction requiring, you know, that requesting that she receive immediate relief for her healthcare need, you know, for obtaining gender reassignment surgery. And that was, we had a really great decision by a judge here in California, a district court judge that mandated that she obtain the healthcare that she needs. And so it was the second time the district court had ruled that. And again, unfortunately, the Attorney General acting on behalf of the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation has appealed that decision. And so we're going to go through that process. They requested a stay, you know, which was denied by the court. But now they're requesting a stay at the Ninth Circuit. So we're, you know, in the process of litigating that case. And we're confident that, you know, in the end, that she'll get the treatment that she needs.
And this is the second time a court has ordered a state corrections department to provide sex reassignment surgery. And that case has been winding its way through the courts for several years, as I understand.
Yeah, it's actually going to be, it's in front of the Supreme Court, who will be making a decision next week on whether or not to hear it or not.
What happens if they choose not to hear it? Do we know exactly what that looks like?
Yeah, unfortunately, that would mean that the First Circuit Court of Appeals opinion, which struck down the Great District Court ruling, would stand, you know, so that would be unfortunate.
So I get, that would put it back in the corrections department's mm-hmm. hands to decide.
Yeah,
whether.
Yeah. I mean, and their facts are different than ours because, you know, they had, you know, I mean, the court in our case, you know, this is really weedy and nerdy. Sorry, folks. The facts in our case are different than theirs in that the First Circuit Court of Appeals felt like there was a significant difference of medical opinion in that case, which, you know, mm-hmm. in the district court in our case even stated that, you know, they didn't cite an opinion on that, which, you know, leads me to believe that they had significant reservations about that reasoning, you know, because the nationally recognized standards of care, which is the World Professional Association of Transgender Healthcare, and internationally recognized standards of care, you know, are the only standards of care. So, you know, this difference of opinion, difference of the medical opinion seems to, you know, imply that there is, you know, a reasonable doubt about, you know, the healthcare that is the guidelines that have been established by the World Professional Association of Transgender Healthcare, which is unreasonable because there really isn't, you know. And if you know anything about this issue, the American Medical Association, the American Psychiatric Association, the American Psychological Association, even the Internal Revenue Service, relying on those standards, has ruled that this care is medically necessary for people, including gender reassignment surgery. So, you know, this idea that somehow there isn't a full consensus, you know, or that they can have an incomplete consensus is completely unreasonable. In our case, however, that wasn't even the case. It was just, you know, there was some testimony that was proffered that was, you know, completely inappropriate. So it's a difference. It's a different set of facts.
You're right, law is nerdy, but it is how we decide who receives benefits from the state's interventions in their lives and who receives violence at the state's hands. So it's always worth educating ourselves about how it all works. It's extraordinarily complex, and there's so many different court systems. I'll never understand all that much about how it works. But
agreed.
We try to have these conversations where we figure out what we need to know and try to get there. And speaking of laws, I want to take a look at these horrific bathroom bills. Florida, Kentucky, Texas. What garbage is going on?
Is this? Well, you know, I mean, I think that, you know, I think it's important to step back too and recognize that, you know, I think that unfortunately, fortunately, a lot of people know a gay and lesbian person. You know, one out of four Americans now know, you know, somebody that identifies as a gay or lesbian. And that's kind of whether it's through TV characters or not, I don't know. But I think that there's a lot of familiarity with who, especially recently in the last few years, with who gay and lesbian people are. And the fear and the myths and the misunderstandings and confusion about, you know, who those folks are has really diminished and erased to a great degree. I mean, there's still a lot of it out there. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to, you know, erase the massive issues that still exist for, you know, gay lesbian people. But there's been a lot of humanizing that's taken place in the last few years, you know, and whether it's because of Ellen, I don't know, you know, but anyway, I think there are, just based on recent polling anyway, more and more people know of or think they know of, you know, they know somebody who identifies that way. Unfortunately, that's not so true for trans folks. You know, only one out of 10 say they have you know, even know a transgender person, you know, and maybe the recent interview with Jenner will help, you know, erase some of that empathy gap, you know, and more people can start to identify, and, you know, more and more people are coming out and telling their stories, and, you know, and I think that we need more stories than just, you know, a Jenner story. I think we need stories, you know, we need to raise up and make visible stories from trans people of color specifically, because I think too often they're erased as part of the narrative, and that's really a critical, important part of this conversation. But I think that there is a lot of fear about who transgender people are, and a lot of mythology, and a lot of, you know, possibly some political calculations from politicians who are trying to seize this to turn out voters, or to, you know, appease constituencies. I don't know what, you know, what the basis is for it, but I'm going to assume good intentions. I'm going to assume just fear and misunderstanding, and part of our work is to defeat those bills, but it's also to humanize transgender people in the process, and that means telling our stories, you know, raising up those other voices and saying, you know, we're just people, you know, and by, you know, telling, you know, by passing laws that would criminalize me for using a restroom consistent with my gender identity, you're creating an already unsafe situation, and transgender people are harassed in public accommodations in almost every circumstance, specifically transgender people of color. And, you know, you're placing me in a highly dangerous situation by telling me that I can't use a bathroom consistent with my gender identity. And, you know, so it's they're ridiculous pieces of legislation, you know, because they're completely unconstitutional. It's not ridiculous, but they're unconstitutional, because there's no way to enforce it. You know, you're going to be faced with floodgates of lawsuits, you know, because who's gonna be the decider? Who's gonna sit in the bathroom and check IDs or check genitalia or whatever standard they decide they want to apply? You know, do chromosomal tests? You know, it's absolutely absurd. And, you know, I think that it's easy to write it off as animus, but I think it's more about, you know, misunderstanding and confusion and myths. And I think that, you know, we'll defeat these. I'm confident. We've already defeated them in Kentucky and Florida. It looks like they're going down to Texas, hopefully, and Nevada and California, but, you know, it's just important in the process, you know, to tell our stories and humanize transgender people, to, you know, take away that boogeyman that's so often used, you know, by the right, because that's who's doing it.
Mm-hmm. And just to touch on a couple of particularly gross aspects here, one of these bills would...
The bounty?
Get to that in a second, but would create a felony class for building owners who allow transgender folks to use a restroom that doesn't match their chromosomes. And it seems to me that is exactly, it's designed to force, I mean, every property owner who has some sort of public space to actually create bathroom monitors. I mean, you would, to avoid this felony charge, you would literally have to sit and, I don't know how you would test people's chromosomes when they just would use the bathroom.
And distrust, and it's just, you know, I don't know what it is that they think that transgender people need to do in the bathroom, but it's just, we just need to go to the bathroom. You know, it's so absurd. Yeah, and it creates this culture of mistrust and oversight and fear that's just awful. Yeah, it's terrible.
And these bounties, a couple of bills are essentially offering money to students to rat out their transgender classmates. Am I understanding this right?
They will. Well, they provide the civil right of action, so you could bring a case that you could, you know, impose a $4,000 fine in one circumstance, you know, that that could be applied to a transgender person or to the public building that allows them to use the bathroom.
And then claimed by the person who does the ratting, is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty gross.
Yeah, it's pretty gross. But again, you know,
and we're talking about students here. I mean, we're talking about encouraging students to do this as well. I mean, when youth.
Yeah.
To be brought into this, and I'm not as gentle as we might consider you to be. I think, you know, a lot of this is about creating identifying people who can be used as pawns, you know, in a political sense, in terms of politics, voting, that sort of thing, gathering money, but also in the sense of politics in trying to halt social change, you know. And so I think there is animus, you know. I think it's in some ways is indirect because it's convenient. You know, there's a new class of people has been identified who can be put in this position. Let's end really quickly on a good note. I'm going to leave it up to you to tell us what it is.
Well, I would just say, you know, I would just go back to Gandhi's quote. You know, I don't know off the top of my head, but, you know, I think it's, you know, first, they've ignored us for years, and we've been able to get a lot of change done, you know, because of that, you know, behind the scenes of working with allies and supporters, and that's been great, you know, and, you know, then they moved to laughing at us, and they still are laughing at us to some degree, but less and less so, you know, and as more people rise and our stories are visibilized, you know, whether it's through Laverne Cox, you know, telling her stories or whoever, you know, all the great Jana Mock and other, you know, leaders of our communities that have, mm-hmm. you know, humanized this and begin to, you know, raise the awareness of who transgender people are. You know, they've gone from laughing at us to fighting us, and that's where we are, and that's okay. You know, we've all been through that. There, you know, we're not the first group, and it's important that we stand in solidarity, whether it's labor or race or, you know, reproductive justice. You know, we have to stand together, and we'll fight it, and they're fighting us. And guess what? As an up note, the next step is we win. So, you know, I'm confident that we are winning, and we'll continue to win, and we'll continue to fight.
Right on. Thank you so much. We've been chatting with Out Loud alumna Sasha Buchert, who works for the Transgender Law Center in Oakland, California. Thanks for all the work you do. And we look forward to
all the work you do.
Yeah, you're welcome. We look forward to talking with you again shortly. You can hear an archive of this show on KBOO.FM. Should post by tomorrow. You can find out what we're doing on Out Loud on Facebook, KBOO Out Loud. Next week, we're going to talk about Medicare and Social Security for LGBTQ folks. We have some other surprise guests that I'm very excited about. Coming up next is Hard Knock Radio, and we're going to hear just a little bit of music. I believe it's Betty LaVette singing her version of Heart of Gold. And this is for DJ Action Slacks. She requested this song a long time ago when she was appearing on the show. And it's she has her Queer Country Junction, which is this Saturday at the Kenton Club, and it's been packed time after time. So queer country music is where it's at right now. DJ Action Slacks at the Kenton Club this Saturday. Thanks so much, everyone.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit